Welcome to this podcast for Classical 91.5. I'm Julia Figueres. This week, your Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra takes to the skies with works by Ligeti, Scriabin, and of course, Holst. Here to talk about this set is this week's guest conductor, Houston Symphony Conductor Emeritus Hans Graf. Maestro Graf, welcome to Rochester.
Thank you.
And thank you for being here. This is a show with just three pieces, but all fabulous. So let's start with Ligeti's Atmospheres. If you could sort of give us a roadmap of what this piece is all about.
Ligeti wrote this piece after his starts in Hungary, when he was just growing out of the Bartok tradition, and after the 56 events in Hungary, when the Russians offered their brotherly help to the Hungarians. Ligeti, as so many other Hungarians, hundred thousands, decided to go to the West. Ligeti stayed in Austria and got a complete restructuring of his musical thinking. And it was not from outside, but it was a new situation. And he decided to try new things, like get over the concept of rhythm, melody, not color, but he found a new thing which you can compare to what people say in German, das Ei des Columbus, the egg of Columbus. When there was a discussion whether an egg could stand on one end and not roll over. And Columbus said, yes, it can. It took the egg and bang, on the table, and the egg stood a little bit broken. So that's a good idea. Like, you can do this music, but it's a one-time thing. Because this piece is so unique, if you try to do it again, it's just an imitation. So it was really groundbreaking, and it stands out of the whole production of really avant-garde music of the 60s as a star, and it's still played and it's still astonishing. It was done in 61, and the title says everything. An atmosphere is consisting of lots of molecules, but you can't distinguish them. So it has temperature, it has pressure. In music, you have lots of individual players. Every string player has an individual part. Every wind player. There are no doubled notes. And it starts with a cluster, which is a word coming from American music, from Cowell, Between the Wars. Cluster is when you put your arm on the piano and press down all the keys. Black and white is a cluster. The orchestra plays from the top to the bottom of the orchestra, all notes, which gives a sound you haven't heard before. There's a sound in acoustics which is called the white noise. The white noise contains all frequencies. And there's colored noise with frequencies selected. You have a cluster at the beginning of all the notes, then later comes a cluster of all the white keys in the strings and all the black keys in the winds, and it changes when the strings get the crescendo, the C major comes out, then it goes away, and the winds do the crescendo, the G flat major comes out, sixth ajouté. So it's like changing colors when you have these Asian tissues, when you turn them, they turn from changer, they turn from blue to red, and the orchestra changes in a way you can't time it. All of a sudden it disappears. It's no end, no beginning. It's fantastic. It's like a piece of meditation.
There was one critic that said that this was a piece that acoustically stood still.
Yes, there's no movement which you feel as a movement, no rhythm. But the time is structured. And then it has a couple of dramatic situations. When you narrow down the cluster, which starts, let's say, from the middle of the orchestra to the higher from the lower, and you narrow it down, and the lower part goes up, and the higher part goes up slower, the cluster gets more narrow, and up, and up and up until it gets together to four piccolo notes. At the highest end, where it's no higher, and so shrill and loud that you have to cover your ear, and all of a sudden there's this shoot, it falls down to the lowest, like in Tartum, in hell, and all kind of double basses play different notes, lowest notes, and it's like a visual thing.
How do you conduct a piece like this? Because
you beat 1, 2, 3, 4.
Do you?
Yeah.
So there's a structure of 1, 2, 3,
yes,
4.
Absolutely. But it's not a rhythm, it's a timing.
This piece was used in A Space Odyssey, 2001,
yes.
A Space Odyssey. Yes. It shows up in deep space. It shows up with the monolith as well. Kubrick never asked permission for it.
Ligeti was offended, and he felt cheated. And there was a lawsuit, but then I think he got his piece. They thought he might be happy to get more popularity. A man like Ligeti is not looking for that popularity. This is, I've been in this movie. Sorry, I'm a composer.
Did he like the way Kubrick used his music?
I don't know. I think he didn't care. I think probably he respected the movie, but he liked the way his pieces played in concert.
Kubrick would go back to Ligeti with permission later on for a couple more movies, but I always found that interesting that lifted.
No, Ligeti is not a movie composer. Like, you know, Stravinsky tried to write for the movies. His music was too good for it and was never accepted. So we have a couple of pieces like the Four Norwegian Moods or the Scherzo alla Russe, which were meant to be a movie music, and Hollywood didn't understand. So Stravinsky didn't make it to be a movie composer. You have to be a little less great composer to be a movie composer.
And this was the piece that made Ligeti famous.
No. Famous among certain people. Famous among mass people, but not among musicians.
Really?
No.
Do you like this piece?
Yes. And I like Ligeti and I like Kubrick very much.
Why? What is it about atmospheres that speaks to you, Hans?
The novelty, the incredible impression the piece is making on every audience, be it musicians or non-musicians, the piece is just speaking for itself. It's fantastic. It's a new concept of concentration or relaxation, of sound, of a completely new quality of silence. Coming from nowhere, going to nowhere at the end, is exemplary.
You've chosen to pair this with Scriabin's The Poem of Ecstasy, which he sometimes called his fourth symphony. But
yes, yeah.
Tell me about that piece.
Well, the combination with Ligeti is and with the planets is nice, and it makes sense because you go to other spaces, and ecstasy is not neither the drug nor a sexual state of mind. It's going out of yourself into space. And Scriabin's ecstasy is like dominating or living in the universe in a completely other sense, not without connotations of human feelings. But the real reason that we play the pieces, sorry, we have this big orchestra on stage, let's use it. Who would bring for Ligeti's 9 minutes all those musicians on stage and then go on with a Mozart?
And also, there's a great sense of suspended time,
yes,
in the Scriabin,
yes,
as well.
Yes, Scriabin's piece is very exotic. I think it's very daring for the time it was written. Not daring like Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. It's a little bit before, but Vienna, like Berg and Schoenberg and Webern, were much more daring than Scriabin. But Scriabin was very much in his own world, and he went away from normal concert music. When you see his biography, how it presents itself when you play through the piano sonatas, they come from the next step of Chopin. To get through his own, he was a virtuoso player like Rachmaninoff, almost same time students in Leningrad, in St. Petersburg. His own virtuosity got more and more, at the service of a completely new musical thinking. From number 5 to number 9, 10, he got more and more, I would say, esoteric. He got more and more personal, and he's not a model for other composers.
Some people actually just thought he was nuts. They just thought he was a madman.
Well, I know a couple of composers who were. He was very much himself, 150%. And that enabled him to write this music, which is a music of highest complexity, but absolutely, absolutely immediate talking to the audience. It's very difficult to play because the score is like meticulously written like a Swiss clockwork. But the result should sound like the greatest freedom and sensuality, and it's a wonderful piece. It couldn't be much longer because you can't stand it. It's like Schoenberg's Transfigured Night is or the other pieces at the edge of tonality. They are so narcotic sometimes, and so beautiful and poisoning. And this is one of those glorious poisoning pieces, but the end is the complete opposite of the end of Ligeti, where Ligeti is going into complete silence. And even in this chorus, you have 3 bars at the end where nothing is happening. And you shouldn't notice the moment when the written music is ending, because there's no change anymore. So this is the complete perfect silence, and in Scriabin it's the complete perfect outbreak of C major, that the whole orchestra is playing C major until they probably explode in C major. And then
he was a synesthete, so
yeah,
he saw color with sound. Can you sense what colors he was seeing?
No, this is a very individual thing, and I think everybody would see other colors. But the idea is great. And he had, in Prometheus, he had also this color piano. And it's very interesting to restore this and to do it. And I think with our technical possibilities, we could do much better than they could then. They didn't have projectors, or they didn't have those LED things which can play everything. It would be great. And probably promising, certainly expensive, to try a new run of this idea of putting colors at the same. But you have a concert hall, and the colors were rather in his head, in his mind, than on a little, a little screen? Looks like a postage stamp. No, the whole world should change color, or the whole concert hall should change color. And I haven't seen that in my life. I imagine it would be great.
Scriabin was, he was not unsuccessful. He was very, very popular, but his biographer said, no one was more famous during their lifetime, and few were more quickly ignored after death.
He was famous, but he was not the most famous. Rachmaninoff was also famous. He was almost the same age. Scriabin was famous among intellectuals. Pasternak loved him. But he was not so played so much. It was difficult to play. And when they played the first performance in Russia, the conductor who was supposed to do it had to give up because he couldn't do it. He was not strong enough, or not clever enough. So somebody did it before him. And then it was a week later that the second performance. And the first performance was in America, and we don't know how it went. And anyhow, we don't know how the first performance of Rite of Spring went. We were not there. I think with our measurements, it must be a mid-sized catastrophe. But
Scriabin left behind no musical acolytes at all. Will we ever, or have we seen anything like him since? He strikes me as unique.
I think that somebody like Szymanowski is in the world of Scriabin a little bit. But this is not really that music is so complicated and so personal, it's not school building. And if you look, Schoenberg, is there another Schoenberg? Berg is completely different. Webern is completely different. Scriabin, you can imitate, you can try to imitate him, will be never as good. And what for? And music took another turn with his not friend Stravinsky, mainly.
They were not friends.
They were not really. Well, Scriabin was not at the conservatory anymore, and Stravinsky was a pupil of Rimsky, whom he really adored. And Rimsky said about the Scriabin's music, this is obscenity. It's obscene, it's not immoral.
That's pretty exciting, actually.
Oh, there were kind of fights at the time. Scriabin and Rachmaninoff were quite good friends, and they both had the piano concerto written at age 18, as you know. First Rachmaninoff and Scriabin piano concerto were extremely young, and both were winners of the piano prize. And Scriabin was very proud and very a loner. He didn't really care for Rachmaninoff, but Rachmaninoff respected him and played sometimes a whole Scriabin evening in his programs.
The highest of honors at the time, I would
yes,
think.
Yes. And there was another great guy named Prokofiev who was sitting in the hall and said, when Rachmaninoff plays Scriabin, it sounds all like Rachmaninoff. But can you imagine? You have in St. Petersburg the young Shostakovich, half generation later, but you have Scriabin, Rachmaninoff, Rimsky-Korsakov, Stravinsky growing up, you have Lyadov, you have coming Prokofiev, and show me a music school nowadays within one decade.
Are there composers nowadays who are going to hold up down the line like that whole list that you just read?
Yeah.
Do you find that we have such a cluster of these composers right now living?
No, not since 50 years.
The second half of
I have a couple of composers I adore.
Who?
John Adams. This is a great composer. He has skills, ideas, he has a heart, he has everything you need. And there's another composer who died a couple of years ago, Dutilleux, Henri Dutilleux, which is Lutoslavsky was very great. So I don't quote more names because every name I don't quote is an offense.
So the second half of the concert is the planets, and it's specifically the planets and HD Odyssey. Did you create this?
It was not me alone. It was the Houston Symphony and its CEO, Matthew van Bissin, who then went to Melbourne, then to New York, and now to Ann Arbor. And we had done the planets in 2003, my second year, with a dusty video. And we had invited NASA astronauts who were on stage with us commenting the planets, the physical planets, astronomically, always pointing to the point of the planets by holes are astrological. It had nothing to do with astronomy. So then they were the first time on stage with a big orchestra. This orchestra produces sound, you can tell, on stage even more. And they were blown away, almost like on a Saturn V. And they said, you are kidding, you played these little pictures there. We have new high-definition material, which is public domain. You should make a new one. Ah, yeah, okay. Then Matthew found Mr. Kopp, who is a filmmaker who worked with NASA quite a bit and had a awarded film, The Dark Side of the Moon. And he said, yes, I can do that. He was an astronomer and video producer. So he did for us, with new material, freshly released, new pictures for the planets. Those videos were made in a raw form, sent to us in Houston. And then I had to do a version on a CD, which then would define the cuts of his video. When the video came back, and there was a couple of invited people from the board, or from the sponsors, from the donors, but it costs money. I heard a couple of people that had tears in their eyes when they saw Mars appearing. Mars is appearing. The screen is huge. That's why it's so expensive. It's huge, filling the whole width of the stage. And then Mars appears like nothing yet. And then comes a little rim. And then it comes up, and then it gets huge and red and has a scar. You know, this valley on Mars, which is 4,000 kilometers long and 40K. Yeah. And at the bottom, the orchestra breaks out, the scar is here. People get goosebumps, and some, oh, that's incredible. And then I had some people saying, you know, it would need more action. I said, no, it doesn't need more action. It's not a movie you're going. It's not a film. It's not telling a story. It's just confronting the real pictures with this genius composer's music. And finally, everybody was joining in. And so we had it played in Houston. It was really attractive. Then we brought it to Carnegie. We brought it to the East Coast. And then we brought it in 2010. A big European tour, which is interesting. Interesting also in a aspect you wouldn't expect. It has a chorus. The Last Planet has an unseen female chorus, which is seemingly innocent. It's incredibly tricky, very risky, breakable, and if it doesn't work, it ruins the end of the concert. Because it goes away like Ligeti, to nothing. The idea before Ligeti. So we had every concert another chorus on tour. That's more cost efficient than take our own chorus. But they understood we couldn't make the tour because it was too heavy financially. So that was... But the English concert organizers to have choruses who can sing the planets upside down because they do that so often. Well, it's a great thing. I think there's not many pieces of music which would allow to be so brutally confronted with pictures. You wouldn't do that to Strauss' Dead and Transfiguration or to a symphony. But this piece is asking for it. And this piece has a guaranteed success formula for our times. People can't listen longer than 7 minutes, then concentration is over. So we have seven-minute pieces.
Now, this is a piece that a few years back in our listener top 40 came in at number 18. So what is the draw of the planets? Is it that ability to cut it into these little seven-minute pieces?
I think the attractivity consists in more than one. First of all, is the bite size. And this is easy for everybody, and you don't have to sit through a Mahler movement of half hour. Then you have to be concentrated and have to be prepared and have to be willing to follow and to think. Here you just lean back and let them play. The other side of it is that it's genius music. Each planet, the astrological planet, helps so much to create a character which then reflects itself very clearly in the character of the piece. So Mars, if it's Mars, it's war. If it's Venus, it's love, or better, peace. If it's Mercury, it's you can't grab it. It's running away like Quicksilver, the same bird. And interesting enough that he was a little bit after the Rite of Spring, so he was way backward compared to Stravinsky, Bach, and Schoenberg, but he was very ambitious and very courageous for his British surroundings. Britain always was kind of conservative, and they don't want to be disturbed in their nice and noble piece. So Mercury is really one of the first complete examples of bitonalität, bitonality. It's in B flat major and in E major at the same time. You see this, the violins, one is in E, one is in B flat, E, viola is in B, cello in E flat, and all, and it changes like I said with the Ligeti cluster, you turn it and it has another color. It you will not notice it. It's da 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 dee do da 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 dee do. I have two tonalities opposed. And that's genius. And it's entertaining. It's also in Neptune, the last one, it's also quite novel to have a chorus that way. It's very difficult, very daring to risk the end of the piece with such a delicate and breakable set for chorus. And the ladies are singing that. They must be very good. And I had yesterday my rehearsal. They are fantastic. They are really great. And this is also a piece which has virtually not much of a tempo. It has colors. Neptune has colors. Saturn, the magician, has power and rhythm. Jupiter has just muscles. And even the muscular melody in the middle is people standing upright and it lends itself to collective upheaval. But Venus is like Debussy, but all a little bit less complicated. Holst is great, simple enough to be eaten immediately. Don't have to learn anything before.
Is there a planet that you find personally very attractive?
I love them all. I find Mercury attractive because it's a real challenge. It's difficult. Difficult for the orchestra. And fun difficult. Not unnecessary difficult.
In this, there is no Earth. No, Earth is not one of the planets that are described.
Well, neither Earth nor Moon, who would be astrological. Mm-hmm. And these are the planets as they were known then. And the order is also not completely right. Going from Sun to the extreme distance, the order is a little bit different. But that doesn't... you need a musical order which has strong, soft, strong, and quick and slow, which makes sense.
So you've created a concert which will begin in nothing and end in nothing.
Yes. Yes. But the nothing at the beginning of Ligeti is not completely, because it starts with a complete entrance of the whole orchestra at once. So there's a beginning. It could be a non-beginning. Debussy has shown it in many beginnings, where there's one single note coming up and then two bars later another note, and then it opens up like a flower, like in Gig or in Ronde de Printemps or even La Mer. But we could probably rewrite the beginning of the Ligeti.
Why not? Why not?
He's not alive anymore. He can't protest.
Right. He can't be mad at you. It's okay. I have to ask you. I've had a couple of maestros who have said that they think ending a piece, as, for example, Holst does, quietly and that fade out, is more difficult than a big end.
It's breakable, and you have to count on the concentration of the people that they don't ruin it. But it depends. Holst ending is very difficult. The Holst ending is very difficult because you have to work a lot on it to make it a little bit more risk-free, but otherwise it's really difficult. The Ligeti ending, conducting three bars with no sound, is not so difficult. No, but it's right. A piece which ends in peace in quiet is always more precious. And for conductors, disappointing because nobody will clap.
I suspect they will this time around.
We'll see.
You don't have an orchestra anymore, do you?
No, I've had my share of 40 years of music director positions.
So you don't miss it?
No, I do a lot of conducting. I conduct what I want. I do not miss committees. I do not miss auditions. But I miss sometimes the great joy of constructing a season. Together with my, but in Houston we did with Aurelie, and we were all four people. The, what is that in China, the Cultural Revolution? The
Gang of Four.
And that's beautiful because it's we are not creative, we are musicians. We are musicians, we are playing other people's creations. Creating a season is a little breath of air of doing something, putting something together which makes sense for many people. And that's beautiful. If a season is well done, well crafted, to look at it, to go through it, and to look back on it is nice.
This is a very well-crafted show, and I think that we are all really excited about seeing this. Thank you very much for coming in and chatting with us.
Thank you for having me.
Hans Graf is our guest. He is the guest conductor for the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra this week, and he is also the Houston Symphony Conductor Emeritus. If you'd like information about the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra season, you can go to rpo.org. I'm Julia Figueres. This podcast is a production of WXXI Public Broadcasting.